Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. I want to remind listeners that beginning on May 10, we're doing fundraising at CIUT, but you can join in the fun anytime you like. That is, you can go to CIUT.fm and donate to keep CIUT running and producing all the great programs. All you have to do is go to CIUT.fm, click on donate, mention the Taylor Report, and we'll all be happy. Again, I'm Phil Taylor, host of the program. Today we're going to be speaking to Stephen Gowans, and later in the show we'll be talking to Otis Richmond and about the George Floyd case and its significance, whether it's a, as they call it, a watershed. I am skeptical. But we're happy now to welcome to the show Stephen Gowans. Are you there, Stephen?
Yes, I am. Hello, Phil.
Good to see you. I have to say to our listeners, we get to see you. Unfortunately, it'll be just audio for them. But you've written a great article, Stephen. It's titled Pandemic Are the Catastrophes of Capitalism, with a subtitle, Make No Mistake, Business Interests Trump Public Health. You set this up very, very nicely, in my view, because, you know, with catastrophes, we know this in history, that sometimes it's a volcano, as in Nicaragua, and sometimes it's floods or famine. And when a pandemic or a great crisis strikes a country, or in this case, the world, we discover who is ruling in the interests of their people and who is probably not, or maybe actually behaving in a way that will further endanger the people. And your stress in the article is on that word, people, which I like very much. I like the title of People's Republic of Anything. This is a good starting point. But you argue this piece, Pandemic, the Catastrophes of Capitalism, that this is empirically demonstrated that people's governments, socialist governments, have performed much better, dramatically better, than have the capitalist orders. Have I got that right?
Yes, you have.
Now, you say empirically. Could you talk about that? How we show this?
Well, I mean, a lot of people have been talking about how well China and Vietnam and Cuba and the People's Republic of China have been doing in managing the pandemic and limiting the spread of the infection and in reduce or at least limiting the number of deaths. And it's true. In fact, they have been doing remarkably well. But some people who want to take issue with the idea that it's communist countries, or those with the people's orientation, as I call them, that are uniquely doing well, they could say, well, it's not the case that they're uniquely doing well. There are some capitalist countries that are doing well too. I mean, there's Australia, there's Japan, there's New Zealand, there's South Korea. And while it's not a country, it's nevertheless a jurisdiction, there's also Taiwan. So you can point to these countries as capitalist countries that have been doing well in terms of managing the pandemic. But you can look at, I've looked at deaths per thousand population as a way of looking at the degree to which countries are managing the pandemic. And I've looked at it over scores and scores of countries. I think I have a data set of about 170 countries. And you can plot deaths per thousand, 100,000 rather, per country, and against what I've done is I've plotted it against GDP per capita on the assumption that the richer the country, the more resources are available for pandemic management and public health. But when you plot all of those countries on those two axes, what you discover is something contrary to what you might expect. So you might expect that the more affluent countries with more resources for public health would have done a better job in managing the pandemic. And quite the opposite is the case. It's the wealthiest countries, countries like the United Kingdom and Italy and the United States and France, that have done very poorly. Whereas countries with very low GDPs per capita relative to these affluent capitalist countries like Vietnam and North Korea, Cuba, the People's Republic of China. And I should quickly add, despite the fact that the People's Republic of China has a very large economy, on a per capita basis, it's still quite small. But so we see an inverse relationship, or the odd, or a relationship which is counterintuitive, which these very wealthy countries doing very poorly in managing the pandemic, and not so affluent communist countries doing exceedingly well in managing the pandemic. So when I say, I made reference to some affluent countries like Australia, Japan, South Korea also doing well. When we look at those, acknowledge that they are doing well, we discover, however, that North Korea, Vietnam, China do as well, for example, as New Zealand or Taiwan, but they do as well with fewer resources. They have lower GDPs per capita, and therefore they have fewer resources to invest in pandemic management and healthcare. I'm actually doing a more elaborate or detailed look at this at the moment. I'm working on it. And if you look at the East Asian countries, which have done very well, what you discover is that while it's the case that Japan and South Korea have done very well, they've not done quite as well as China. I mean, China is unparalleled within the East Asian group. Likewise, if you look at the Southeast Asian nations, they too, as a group, have done very well, but they have not done as well as Vietnam, which stands out head and shoulders above those countries. Cuba hasn't done as well as the three East Asian or Southeast Asian communist countries, but they have done very well relative to the capitalist countries as a whole. When you look at those four communist countries in terms of pandemic management and deaths per 100,000 versus the capitalist world as a whole, their performance is outstanding. So that invites the question, why is it that these communist countries, which have limited resources, have done so well at curbing the spread of the infection and at saving lives? And why is it the capitalist world has done so poorly?
Yeah. I was looking at the data today just to get, and it is so actually shocking. There are, we have 8,000 deaths in Ontario. China has, at this point, 4,636. We have in the province of Ontario more than deaths than occurred in China. The United States has, of course, 526 million. You know, it's almost criminal what is going on. Part of your article emphasizes that we're up against ideology. I mean, I don't think you used the word exactly there, but you point out that ruling ideas. So the ruling idea is that we can trust people who have monopolies in long-term care. We can trust people who have monopolies in pharmaceutical goods, and they'll give us a plan and it'll all work out. But this began January, for us, January 2020. It's now a year and a half later. and our ruling papers are full of discussions of, well, how shall we handle this? Meanwhile, we're sitting alongside a Security Council member with very good relations, by the way, with the World Health Organization, which speaks admiringly of their work. And we can't get from point A to B with that. We can't follow that because there's an ideological problem, right?
Yeah, that's true. And on a number of levels as well. And, you know, just to underscore how well China and the communist countries have been doing, I've been doing some work with the more expanded data set, as I mentioned. And if we look at that, what you can show is that had all the capitalist countries managed the pandemic as effectively as the communist-led countries had, over 147 million people would have been spared the illness and over 3 million lives would have been saved. And they accomplished this without vaccines, because the vaccine rollout within those countries is very limited. But in terms of ideology, as you were mentioning, I think the ideology we have here is the ideology of, well, it's a capitalist ideology. And it's a capitalist ideology in which public health is subordinate to other concerns. And the primary concern in any capitalist country is profits, not public health. And it's true that capitalist countries and jurisdictions, the article I wrote was looked at Ontario specifically, it's true that those governments are concerned with public health, but they're concerned with public health on capitalism's terms, in the same way that the United States is concerned with peace in North Korea on US terms. Yeah. So in Ontario, for example, which I looked at, I mean, there's no doubt that the government is concerned about public health, but only so far as it's necessary to protect the interests of the business community or the significant business community in Ontario. But we can see this not only in Ontario, but across the world. An example comes today from India, where, as we know, there's, the coronavirus pandemic is running out of control. In today's New York Times, has been pointed out that the administration in India of Modi has been determined to cast an image of India as open for business. And so dismissed warnings by scientists in that country that India had not achieved herd immunity, as the government wanted to insert.
The discussion of such odd ideas got loose. I can remember what Trump and everybody else were all waiting for herd immunity as if we were a bunch of cattle. I mean, and that was like a curse, such a dumb idea.
Yes, it was. But I mean, this is consistent with what happened in Ontario, where we had the science table, so the epidemiologists and virologists, the scientists and healthcare professionals who the province had appointed to provide them with advice on how to manage the pandemic, providing advice and the Ontario government ignoring it and doing what the science table said the government ought not to do, and then those scientists becoming bewildered. How is it that our advice is being rejected and asking the question, is the Ontario government really not concerned about public health? And I think the answer became obvious. No, they're not concerned about public health, because the principal recommendation that the science table made was to close non-essential businesses. And that's something that capitalist governments have difficulty coming to terms with, as the Modi government in India has had difficulty coming to terms with. And these have predictable consequences. Mm-hmm. But this is the idea of protecting public health on capitalist terms is also evidenced in something I wrote, or not wrote, read today. And this is the movement to develop the people's vaccine, which is a movement to waive patent rights on, say, the Moderna and Pfizer and AstraZeneca vaccines, and to share the recipe for making these vaccines publicly so that the vaccines could be produced generically across the world in, you know, so you could take advantage of spare pharmaceutical capacity in order to hasten the distribution of the vaccine throughout the world, because it's now expected that people in poorer parts of the world will not be vaccinated until 2024. Well, there has been a considerable backlash against this idea within the pharmaceutical industry, for example, not surprisingly, within the business community, which wants to ensure that intellectual property is protected and it's never breached. But interestingly, we saw, you may have seen the objection of Bill Gates. And Bill Gates's argument is essentially, he said, well, you know, in global health, it takes a decade between when a vaccine comes into the rich world and when it comes into the poor country. So in this case, it's not going to take a decade because of my charitable efforts in terms of COVAX. So, you know, we cannot waive these intellectual property rights. We cannot share this information widely. Well, why not? Well, because you're protecting public health on capitalism's terms. Who do you have to protect first? Who do you have to protect first? Investor. Public health comes second.
Actually, yeah, you can. The formula becomes it's anti-people. You know, profits before people. By the way, we're speaking to Stephen Gowans, gowans.blog. And by the way, Stephen, you're very more busy than usual on Twitter. People should go Twitter at Gowans Stephen. Actually, you had something shocking on there today. I'm trying to, I'll look it up as we go, but yes, that the rate of infection is as high in Ontario as India. Did I get that right?
Yes, it was.
That's a worrying piece of information. Not worrying. It's a, I guess it's a factual matter that should actually be mentioned.
It was the number of infections per 100,000 was exactly one day last week, the same in Canada as it was in India. The big difference, though, is that India doesn't have the resources to deal with infections to the extent that Canada does. So having an infection rate that high in Canada is not as catastrophic as it is in a poor country, but it still is an indication of the extent to which Canada has allowed the virus to spread. And we've allowed the virus to spread because governments refuse to take the advice of epidemiologists and others in public health who've recommended measures such as temporarily shutting non-essential businesses, not essential businesses, but non-essential businesses, and governments refuse to comply with that advice or to follow it. Mm-hmm. Because, again, what's more important, the health of people in Canada or the profits of business owners and investors?
Yeah. Going to the point about ideology, it is so painful politically to think about this, that here we have a country, 1.4 billion, and you point out, and we should probably I gotta make sure we underline it, they contained the virus. They actually contained it. And then they cooperated with the World Health Organization. They brought them in and they were examined and they talked with them. The United States has never invited the World Health Organization to come visit them and help them assess their success. Further, the Chinese have been helping the developing countries, providing, now they have a vaccine they're providing. They provide the other medical facilities that they can and are able to, and they're way ahead of other countries in doing that. And so you put all those pluses together and then you hit the minus, which is that we have to confront them. We mustn't let them get ahead. And you would say, well, look, if we're all want to stay on the planet together, it seems like they seem to be more pro-planet and the people living on it than the people who are going to rescue us from them. And yet the power of ideology is that, well, I guess I could put it this way, 500,000 deaths, that's freedom. We must be a free country. We got 500,000 dead people.
Yeah. Well, there's also an ideological competition as well, at least from the American side. And we've seen Biden talking about the United States as in a competition with China. And there's certainly a competition to demonstrate which government is the most effective. And I think that Biden has kind of tacitly acknowledged that maybe the Chinese are the more competent government. They've certainly been far more competent in managing the pandemic. No one can argue about that, which is probably why these efforts are being made by the United States to somehow implicate the Chinese in the origins of the pandemic, as if somehow the pandemic is a Chinese fault.
Yeah, they've developed a whole line of reasoning, which actually is further driving the population mad by absurd arguments, all diverting the us from our problem, which was, we have a common problem of fighting a pandemic, but they have raised all these issues that have more and more fantasy. And as you know, fantasy is a dangerous place to be living because it leads into dangerous content. But they seem to be almost on a roll with this. I don't, there's among the American rulers, I don't see any slowing down of this idea that this successful socialist country, which seems to be an example to the world, has to be dealt with because it is successful.
Yeah, I mean, it has to be traduced, it has to be demonized, it has to be made to seem like it's some kind of horrific country. And there has to be a competition, that's the way it's presented. Interestingly, with regard to the effort to develop the people vaccine by waiving patent rights and sharing information, one of the arguments against this is being raised in the United States is that if you allow information, say, about the mRNA platform for the Moderna and Pfizer vaccine to be shared widely, then the Chinese will get it. They'll might use this to develop cancer drugs or whatever, which would simply, you know.
Well, you remember when they allowed the Russians to get a hold of German scientists, otherwise we'd have been fine. You know, so much of this is just a retread of, you know, the old Cold War game. You know, they might hack us. And you say, well, we seem to be pretty well hacked because they're way out ahead. You know, they have the story upside down. Speaking of Stephen Gowans, Gowans.blog, by the way, Stephen has a great book on Syria, which is very apropos of our times, Washington's Long War on Syria. I want to remind you of that. That's Baraka Books. Going back to bringing us back to Ontario for a moment, you point out something, I wish more people would do this. Who are the people who make our big decisions? These decisions about what's an essential business, whether you can play golf, et cetera. It's a cabinet and you kind of break it down. I think people ought to, that's a very good place for the ordinary person to start. Who are they?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I want to demonstrate was if you're going to argue that decisions about public health are being subordinated to the interests of business, people can object to that. Well, one of the ways to demonstrate is to look, as you said, who's making the decision? Who's in the cabinet? Well, who's in the cabinet? In the Ontario cabinet are business people with business interests. And if we look, at the premier. The premier is a co-owner of a manufacturing firm, an inessential business, which continues to operate. So closing an inessential business would obviously hurt him in his pocketbook. It's not in his interest to close inessential businesses. And everyone else in that cabinet has intimate connections with the business community, either as high-level executives in large firms, as the head of a chamber of commerce, or we look at Carolyn Mulroney, for example, has 1,000 connections to the large business community in so many various ways. So these are people who have a class interest. And so not surprisingly, they make decisions that comport with the interests of the class to which they belong and on whose behalf they make decisions. And they're quite open, I think, about this. I mean, they campaign for a mandate on the basis of the fact that they're going to make Ontario open for business. They're going to, they're going to accommodate business concerns because this was apparently the pathway to jobs and prosperity in Ontario. It's apparently also become the pathway to a COVID catastrophe as well.
Mm-hmm. They really ought to be hung on their own petard, but of course we don't have a media which does this, but that was the phrase across the board, also in Washington, and remains so actually in Washington, which is, well, you know, we can't shut the economy down. You know, I remember they all said that. We have to be open for business. And the answer would be, well, if it's going to save us, we will. And then there's the oldest joke question, you know, which is, what do you mean we? You know, the famous conversation between the Lone Ranger and Tonto. And he said, we're surrounded. And Tonto says, what do you mean we? We're the unconsulted. Actually, in any class analysis, as you point out in your writing, 90% of us are actually wage earners, work for a living. And that 90% is not consulted.
No. And I found fascinating during the past weeks, following the Twitter feeds of some of the critical care physicians and other scientists who have been making recommendations to the government, and watching this slow realization on their part that the government really wasn't interested in public health, and coming to the realization that it was the business community that whose interest the government was really interested in. It was fascinating to watch this process unfold, as if the scales had fallen from their eyes. But it was a difficult concept, I think, for many of them to grasp, because they approached it tentatively, almost in a questioning way. Could it be that, in fact, this government is not concerned with public health? There is one critical care physician who said, I've been thinking about this, and the role of government with regard to public health is to protect the community. But I can't figure out, therefore, why it is that the government has behaved in the manner it has.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Stephen Gowans, gowans.blog, and Twitter, @Gowans. Stephen, and I guess I better ask you, why don't we have a Canadian-produced vaccine?
Pardon me, why don't we have one?
Did we ask for permission? I mean, did the U.S. say we could or couldn't?
Have a Canadian-produced vaccine.
We're developing.
In the sense of license to produce, say, the Moderna or Pfizer vaccine? Is that what you're getting at?
Well, you know, you've probably seen Linda McQuaig and others talking about this.
Yes.
We don't have a pharmaceutical base which would have been given that problem immediately, right? They make it and make it now.
Yes, and she was referring specifically to the Connaught Laboratories in Toronto, which had been sold by the Mulroney government to, I believe it was a European firm. But there are a number of countries that have their own indigenous pharmaceutical industry that are working on vaccines. But you're right, Canada's...
You know, it goes back to that question of who, if it's a people's government or is it a monopolist government? Because, of course, if you ask, put it to the people, should we have it? The answer would be yes.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't put it to them, actually. We put it to somebody else.
Well, Canadians or Canada, the Canadian government allowed the Canadian economy to be integrated into that of the United States. And now that it's integrated into that of the United States, we discover, which we should have known all along, that it's America first. And when push comes to shove, it's not Canada that's going to benefit. Canada that loses, because we've essentially relinquished any kind of independence or sovereignty we have, what little we ever had.
Yeah, and actually there's no proof that we want it. We had one of those, you know, there used to be a thing called the patriotic bourgeoisie, and in some countries, we don't seem to have one.
Nope, not at all.
We had a little group from the Liberal Party, the rump of the Liberal Party, who said, maybe we should let Meng Wanzhou go. She didn't break any Canadian laws, and that fell into the memory hole. I don't know if anybody can remember the names of the people who said that. We're speaking to Stephen Gowans, gowans.blog at Gowans, and Twitter at Gowans Stephen. In the moments remaining here, you raised this issue, and it's kind of sad, really. That is, well, are we learning? The problem is we only get to learn by sort of what's available to us. Information is not under our control. We do learn a little bit, I suppose, as you've laid it out, empirically, socialist countries perform better. If you're worried about your health, you need them, one of those. But there is a question, to what extent can we actually learn and transform our own situation? And that, we come up against a class issue, right? I mean, the question won't be posed certainly by monopoly media, and certainly we have a government where from NDP to Green to Bloc or whatever, they're all satisfied with capitalism. So it's going to be, I guess we have to say, do we not, that if you want a people's system, if you want a successful system, you're going to have to fight for that. Nobody here is interested in giving it to you.
No, they're not. But before fighting, one has to come to a recognition that there is a systemic problem. And it's during times of crisis that people are likely to come to that realization. There are even signs in mainstream and even conservative media that something is amiss. For example, there was a columnist in the Globe and Mail, I can't recall his name, who recently wrote...
Gary Mason.
Yes, it was, here's the rule for Canadians, you're on your own because the government is no concern about your welfare. As he wrote with respect to the pandemic, because I think some people had believed the deception that the role of government is to promote the welfare of the people rather than the welfare of a small, segment of the population concerned with large enterprise. And now there's a dissonance between what they believe and what they see governments doing. And this is at least leading some people to ask, I shouldn't say some, but many people to start asking relevant questions. About, if we have a democracy, it's a democracy for who? Yes. If we have a government, it's a government acting on whose behalf?
Yes. There used to be that expression, well, there is a proverbial, the emperor has no clothes. In Canada, the emperor has no healthcare system. I recall reading history that actually in the 1930s, when they began to really have problems with the Great Depression, that they became very worried about the existence of the Soviet Union because they weren't having unemployment. And they seemed to be able to feed, clothe, and educate and build things. The ruling class now seems to have a similar kind of headache.
Absolutely. And this is a benefit to people in Canada and the United States and the Western world, just as competition with the Soviet Union benefited people in the Western world. But you can see this happening now with Biden recognizing that there's a competition. And the response to that competition, as we've seen in the last week, is to announce essentially, although no one's ever acknowledging this, in many ways, emulating the Chinese model. Because, you've announced these enormous investments in infrastructure, in childcare, in job creation. To me, it looks like an emulation of China.
Very good.
And arguing that we have to demonstrate that democracy still works, which is implicitly saying that people are questioning this thing that they call democracy in the United States when it's juxtaposed against China, which seems to be a far more competent government.
Yeah.
In so many ways.
So many. Yes. That I really like this point. I think it's very important because you and I both know, and you've written about this, that with the demise of the Soviet Union, they became very barbaric and triumphalist. And they said, it's the end of history. There's only one system. It's the capitalist system. We don't need trade unions, and you're not going to have any labor rights, and we don't have to care about your health care. And then all of a sudden, they're looking at the People's Republic of China and swallowing and saying, well, maybe we could make some concessions here. Stephen Gowans, it's great to talk to you. Gowans.blog and Twitter at Gowans Stephen. And of course, the great book, Washington's Long War on Syria, which everybody should have right now on their table because that's a burning issue. Stephen, thanks very much. It was great talking to you.
Thank you, Phil.
The CIUT, the Taylor Report, and we'll be back more later.